building.
I think it was,
You could always get the opportunity of doing something like that.
Well, are these pictures gonna go on a statewide tour or anything
they
besides
might.
Being...
There's talk of that.
It depends on whether you get the grant.
That's right. I've got an Arts Council grant and I've got a Humanities grant, but I still need another $30,000 from public contributions. So we're going to do a story.
Did you try
I would like to see it go on a tour.
Yeah, I would too.
I mean, that's an aspect of living here. Do you think people were interested in, I mean, people seem very interested in this sort of thing.
Yeah. He says, don't I look cute?
Oh, you silly dog.
I'm a nice little doggy, yeah. Yeah, I'm a real fine little doggy.
Well, tell me, how did you get started in journalism?
Oh, my dad owned weekly newspapers. Just sort of fell into it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I used to work in the summers and things like that, you know. But not so much as I did like coming north on a fishing boat.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's how you first got to know Alaska, was coming north and working on a fishing boat?
And then I went to university starting every fall.
Mm-hmm.
And
was this in the West Coast then? You came on fishing. Was this on the West Coast?
Yeah.
You came on fishing boats out of Seattle, and then. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then I got a job in the old Seattle Star when I got out of school.
Mm-hmm.
And got fired after 3 weeks. I said I'd never become a newspaper man. The city editor told me that. A few years later, I made him eat it. I made him eat it before a few years because I hitchhiked to New York and got a job in the old New York Herald Tribune.
Mm.
I was getting $15 a week in the Seattle Star, and I got $35 to start with in the New York Herald Trib.
Good for you.
And I had the greatest city editor that ever lived. His name was Stanley Walker. And the first thing off the bat, I hitchhiked all the way to New York, and I was broke, you know. And just had a few dollars when I got in there, and I got a room for about $3 a week. I went and applied for this job and was hired immediately.
Oh, that's
wonderful.
And,
God, I didn't know what to do. I was frightened. Big city room with about 200 people in it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I got my first assignment, and it was to interview a missionary from North China that had just come in. So I went up all the way to the brand new Waldorf Astoria Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
Like all missionaries, they lived like kings everywhere they went, you know, off the poor people's money, just as they do now.
Yeah,
you know.
I'm sure that's true.
So, then I found my way on the subway back down to the office, and I wrote my story and turned it in. And at 9 o'clock at night, well, the first edition of the morning papers, the first papers came up, and the copy boys were throwing them all the desks. And I found my story about page 48 or something.
Yeah.
But it was a top head on it. And the picture, the guy, I had a photog with me going up. And I'd read it over about four or five times, you know. And
mm-hmm.
When all of a sudden, way on the other side of the room, there was a hallway. And here a guy came walking along, just swinging his papers, held right in the middle and all fanned out, you know, on both sides. He went to the city editor's battery of assistants, and they finally figured out who that guy was that wrote it. There was no byline on it, you know. But anyway, finally, and I started looking over the top of my paper, you know, and boy, everything just went quiet all of a sudden. Not a typewriter clicked. And finally, an assistant city editor pointed right like that, and they hit me right square in the middle of the, between the eyes. Boy, he came charging down there, and I said, oh, I lost my job already, you know. And he came charging up to me, and he says, your name Gregory? I said, yes, sir. He says, you have committed a cardinal sin. And I said, I didn't know that. I'm not religious, so I just don't know what a cardinal sin is. And that. He said, God damn it, you shut up while I talk to you. Uh-huh. So he said, look at there. You called a goddamn preacher a minister. A minister is part of the diplomatic corps, and it's insulting to him to have a preacher, goddamn preacher, called a minister. Whew. I said, well, the dictionary, I don't give a goddamn what the dictionary says. That guy is a goddamn preacher, and don't ever forget it. He turned on his heel and walked away. Whew. Scared the hell out of me. And then about 3 hours later, I was rewriting handouts, like regular people call them press releases. Mm-hmm. Have to be rewritten, you know. And so here he comes down, but he's quiet and calm, just walking along, you know, and he came down and he says, son, what time do you get off tonight? I said, well, I don't know. I came to work at 6 o'clock. Here he is. He's going to fire me now. He said, well, come on, get your hat. So we went up to the assistant city editors, and he says, Gregory here and I are going out and have a little chat. He won't be back tonight. God.
So,
now this is in Prohibition, you know. Uh-huh. So we went out to the freight elevators, went down to the loading dock where they loaded the papers on the trucks. And he's, well, son, he says, where do you want to eat? And I said, I don't know. I haven't eaten here before. I'm brand new, you know. He said, well, down there is Clancy's Saloon on that corner of the alley. And I don't know if those are the right names, but he uses. And on this corner is Sullivan's Saloon. Where do you want to go? I said, well, I don't know. I just follow you. So he went up to this one. And he rang the bell, and the guy looked out people. He says, oh, yeah, Mr. Walker, come on in. So he got inside. Well, he said, well, now this is Gregory. He said, one of our new reporters. Whenever he wants to come in, let him in. He's okay. Don't worry about him. So he went in, and there was a bar that I swear is as long as this room, I mean this building. Mm-hmm. And then on the opposite and on the back wall, there was a layout of cold cuts and all that. Gosh, clam nectar and oh, everything that went with it. And a glass of beer was 2 bits and it was about that tall. And that was brewery beer, mm-hmm. See, despite Prohibition. So we got a beer, and he said, well, we'll get back here now and fix up a sandwich. So then we got to talking, you know, and he was telling me his philosophy on life and all that. But it was always a bunch of sons of bitches, these preachers. He says, I hope you won't feel too badly about me chewing out, but he says, it just makes the air blue around me when somebody refers to a preacher as a minister. And he said, don't ever forget it. And I never did.
I bet you didn't.
As a matter of fact, since that, when I've had a reference to a preacher or pastor change to a minister, I've raised particular hell about it. Mm-hmm. And I came close to firing a girl one time because she repeatedly did it. Mm-hmm. And she was a Christer type herself. Mm-hmm. And I told her if I'd known she was, I wouldn't have hired her. Oh, I'm a bitch on that, believe me.
Well, that's okay. I mean, if you were talking to somebody now about your philosophy in life, what would you say?
Well, I'm my own boss. I do what I please, and I don't try to push it on anybody else. But neither do I want anyone to push their silly beliefs on me. Mm-hmm. I just won't tolerate it for 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. I love life and everything, and I like to get around and have a good time and everything. But I have no time for these narrow-minded bastards. They're so narrow-minded they have to part their hair on the side. Mm-hmm. And, God.
Well, aside from a religious standpoint, how would you term your philosophy of life now?
My what?
Your philosophy of life, aside from a religious standpoint. I don't mean in that standpoint. I mean your everyday. You're looking at life from all of your what? How many? How old are you now?
74.
74 years. When you look at what sort of, have you come to any conclusions about life?
Oh yeah, it's good as long as a person does it right, you know, and he's appreciative and he's friendly with people and never gets upset easily.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of thing, you know. You see, the thing that turned me against religion was my father. He threw me out of the church. That's what it amounted to.
Oh, that's good.
Because he forced me to go to every goddamn thing they had, Epworth League and all this crap. Mm-hmm. And finally, on a Sunday afternoon, I was on a championship baseball team. And the game was rained out on Saturday, and they had to put it over till Sunday, but he wouldn't let me play because it was Sunday.
Yeah.
So I stood up to him and I said, Father, when I get out, I was 16, when I get out on my own, I will never, under any circumstances, enter a church except for a wedding or a funeral. And when I got up off the floor, my new bridge work, I'd had my teeth kicked out and blocking a punt in football, where it broken out and it cost him all that money to have him replaced, he hit me so hard. I just went right off my feet and landed on my back, right in the living room floor. So, but my father could do no wrong, and my mother wouldn't argue with him.
It's too bad.
Yeah.
That's just obviously very bad.
Oh, he was narrow-minded, God.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That's too bad, because I don't think all people that go to church are like that. I mean, and I don't think, but this isn't, I'm not trying to change your mind or anything. That's not what I'm saying.
Oh,
but
not,
I think so
not
often,
all of them are like that.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of them are hypocrites.
I think a lot of people are hypocrites, yes. And
sure.
Some people, yeah. And
sure.
I think this is a problem in any form.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, then when I got married, I had a couple of children. And when it came to that church stuff, I said that it's up to them to make up their own minds. And, these people come and want them to come to Sunday school and all this stuff. And they want me to just tell them to. I say, look,
no.
I'm not going to do it. If those children want to go to Sunday school, I don't give a goddamn what kind of a Sunday school is or anything else. If they want to go, they'll go. And, you're doing the wrong thing. I said, you're telling me?
Boy,
that was the last thing the guy should have said,
that's
that one guy.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And I call him a narrow-minded hypocrite. And, you know this Baptist preacher down in Anchorage who is the head of the moral majority? What the hell is his name?
I don't know, but I don't mean
anything. Well, when Carter came out going to Japan,
mm-hmm.
and I was one of those invited by the White House to get down there to reception for him and press conference at the, see, they didn't have to check on me. I was already checked out having worked in Washington, you know.
I see,
So, it was in the officers' club in the bar at George Sullivan, the then mayor of Anchorage, introduced me to this narrow-minded bastard. So, you know, I just kind of...
How did he get an invitation?
Well, it's just one of those things, you know. They get some preachers into all that crap. That's why I don't belong to things like the Rotary, praying like that. They insist on praying before lunch. I think those people, if they want to pray, let them pray at home. What the hell? Why bother so many people who don't believe in that crap? So, anyway, he was asking, he was getting to, about my religious faith and all that stuff. I said, my religious faith is my own business. See, I don't have any formal religious faith whatever. But whatever it is, or maybe, is my own business. Now don't start getting personal with me, fella. He didn't, he's not used to having people addressing
Hiya, Carl. I'm sure he's intimidated by, most people are intimidated by him, and therefore, you know, are immediately answered without any thought. Anyway, what happened? So you continued to work on the New York trip?
No, after 2 years, I had a chance to go to Buenos Aires on a British-owned newspaper, Buenos Aires Herald. And they, I went in and I told Walker what I wanted to do, and he said, you're crazy. He said, you don't want to get down there. I said, well, I want to get around the world to see things. And he says, well, look, come in and see me in a couple of weeks. So I wasn't going for a month. And he said, I hope you'll change your mind. He said, you're just nuts for wanting to do that, son. He said, you call me son all the time. And so finally I went back in 2 weeks and I told him I was dead set on going. He said, all right, God damn it, go. He says, you won't find out without trying it what a silly idea it is. You'll be back here in a few months. So I went, and I worked in Buenos Aires for about a year covering American enterprise down there, the packing companies and all that stuff, you know, and Pan Am, which had just started flying these flying boats between South American ports like Buenos Aires and Montevideo and Santos, Rio de Janeiro, Pernambuco, and so on, right on up to Miami. And I covered them all the time, and so I got this cable from my mother in Seattle saying that my father wasn't expected to live more than 2 weeks, and he had a heart problem, and he'd been in the hospital for months, and so on. And so I resigned, and in those days a newspaper man could get a ride for free, the days before the CAA. And so I went over to see my friend who was general manager for Pan Am, and he fix it up for me to go. They flew only in the daytime in those days. And every night you'd sit down at some port or something, and every time there was a rain squall, you sat down. See, they're coming along the coast where a lot of lakes and things like that. And I can hold it up there. And so I got to Miami and the old Chicago and Southern, which is now part of Delta, arranged for me to go fly into Chicago, where those people had arranged for me to fly on United to Seattle by way of Denver. So in 10 days, I think it was, I was home again in Seattle. So after my dad died, I went down to Seattle Star again. And I made him listen to my story and everything. He says, well, he says, you want to work a while? And I said, well, yeah, but how much? He said, oh, I can give you $30 a week. I said, no, I'm sick and tired of that kind of crap. I'm all through with it. I'm going to get a decent salary or else. So I got him up to $50 a week, which was unheard of. And he was, boy, telling everybody what a job I was doing and all that stuff. And every time I got a chance, I'd say, yeah, and you told me I'd never become a newspaper man. So I had applied to the North China Daily News for a job, which was also British owned by the same group. So I got a cable from them saying that the job was open and they'd like to see me within the next month or so.
Wow,
of course, by then,
exciting.
They had to go on by steamer, you know, the President Line. And I'd been saving some money, so I had, a couple $1,000, I guess. So I got a ticket on it, and I waited till the day before I was leaving. And when I came into the office in the afternoon, I said to Stu Whitehead, the city editor, I said, I'm leaving you. This is my last day. You can't just run out on us. We just hired you, and look at what you're getting and all that. Is that any appreciation? I said, no, you son of a bitch. I'm just getting back at you for what you did to me. Now we're even. With that, I walked out. So I went to the North China Daily News in Shanghai.
Bye. That must have been a wonderful experience.
Yeah. Gee, over there in that international settlement, you know, where all the Europeans, so to speak, live, they're just one party after another. And God, if you skipped one, well, you were just ostracized. Well, gee, after 6 months, I said, no more of this. I can't stay out till 4 o'clock in the morning and be on the job at 7 o'clock. So I didn't have very much money. And I went along the Bund, they called it, the Wangpu River, not the Yangtze, goes by Shanghai. So I couldn't find a ship that I could get on with the kind of money I had until I came to a Japanese tramp. We used to call them Japs then. And it was on the way to somewhere in the South Pacific. But it was going to graze, as they say, Hawaii. So for $100, I got a room up behind the bridge on it with a straw, on the cot.
Yeah.
And I spent money on a whole bunch of reading material and so on. And I couldn't speak any Japanese, and they couldn't speak any English. They'd look at me and point at me and laugh, you know, and which was, boy, I just got so I had no use for those Japs. So we went to Nagasaki, which was the receiver of the second atomic bomb, remember, in World War II? Went there to coal, take on coal. It wasn't an oil burner.
Wow.
Filthy, dirty old ship. So it took 30 days to go from Nagasaki to Honolulu, when it takes a president boat about 9 days. So they put me ashore, and there I was with only a few dollars. So I went up to the bulletin, the newspaper, and told him I'd like to get a job if I could work just long enough to get back to the mainland. So I went to work there, and when I was ready to leave for the mainland, then the city editor talked me into sticking around a while. And I did. I stayed there almost a year.
Oh, my.
And then I went to San Francisco on the old Malolo. She was a real...
The old Malone?
Malolo. M-O-L-O-L-O. Mm-hmm. So, got to San Francisco I went to work on the call bulletin.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on the call bulletin until about 1937, I guess. And then I went to Chicago for the old United Press. And then finally, to New York. I was back in New York again, and they transferred me to New York, and then in 42, I guess it was, they transferred me to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took a...
What paper were you working for then, the Democratic Tribune?
What?
What paper were you working for then?
Oh, in Washington?
Mm-hmm.
With the United Press.
Oh, you're still with UP, okay.
And now UPI. And so then that brings us up to about yesterday, I guess.
You've got a better memory than I have of yesterday. Yesterday, where were we? We were in... I didn't review the tape, so that I have to think of where we started. You were in Seattle, and you had come up here, and you remembered you had come up here working, and you decided to come up.
Yeah.
And you came to Fairbanks, and there was no job went on Ketchikan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's great. That pulls us up that part. All right, let's hear more of the times in Alaska, or more of your philosophy of life, or what you thought as you've gone around and done all of these things.
How do you mean that?
Well, I mean, give me some of your impressions of Alaskan life, how you felt you fit into it, or how you feel other people fit into it, from your observations of being here so many years.
Well, I don't know. There's something that draws me back every time.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I go outside on vacation or something, I can't wait to get back. It's just a great urge all the time, and I'm just proud as hell to be in Alaska, you know, that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't stand to hear people say nasty things about Alaska, and I tell them off usually in some pretty plain language. And I notice that a lot of people, you know, they go outside and they're never coming back, but the next thing you know, they're back.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a magnet, you know, it draws you back, to me anyway.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that's so?
Well, I don't know. I think it means you've just fitted your way into this way of life,
mm-hmm.
and you don't want to let it out of your grasp.
And what way of life is that you fit it into?
Well, it's sort of the spirit of the thing, the usually it's the way people are.
Mm-hmm.
They're nice to you and understanding and so on, as a rule.
Mm-hmm.
I've already told you about similar or otherwise.
Yeah.
And but I think it's just something that was waiting for me to show up.
Yes, I think that's
to impress me.
Mm-hmm.
And my family, at first they thought it was awful, you know, my sisters and brothers and everything. But now they understand. And
it's
some
okay,
of
just use the floor here. Mm-hmm, I think.
Some of the family have been here, and they caught, you know, they sort of caught the disease too.
Mm-hmm.
And so they understand now why I like it here, despite bitter cold winters and the problems that the cold give mm-hmm. you for staying alive and fit.
Okay, that's